Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM. And all that is now, and all that is gone, and all that's begun, and everything under the sun is in view, but the sun is a quick spot on me.
Hello, good evening and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Firstly, good evening, John.
And good evening, Ben. Hi, everyone.
Hi, everyone, indeed, as ever. Our email address, if you have any queries, questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. The email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number for the next 28 minutes or so is 087-179-1032. Love to hear from you. That's 087-179-1032. And we're going to start, as usual, what to see in the night sky.
Yep. Space station out of sight, unfortunately, until March the 14th. No, I'm not going to say out of sight. Evening passes only March the 14th until March the 28th. Mercury, out of sight, deep in the sunrise at the moment, so no chance really of seeing that. Venus, -3.9, which is a good, bright planet just at the moment, but it's quite hard to see. It's low in the southeast during dawn, and it's a little lower every morning, so we're losing Venus just as we speak. Mars, on the other hand, +1.3, it remains deep in the sunrise, but will sneak back into our morning skies very shortly over the next month or so. And Jupiter, -2.3 in Aries, is at the bright, and it's the bright white dot almost straight above our heads just at the moment. And lower in the west-south-west later as it creeps towards the horizon. It sets around 11 midnight, depending where you are. And in a telescope, it has shrunk to only 38 arc seconds wide if you're an arc seconds type of person. Saturn, +1, is disappearing into the sunset low, so we're losing it as well, unfortunately. Uranus, 5.7 in Aries, remains 11 degrees upper left of Jupiter, so if you are out hunting for Uranus, you will get to see it quite easily, but if you have a good pair of binoculars or a telescope, you have the vicinity of where it is. And Neptune, unfortunately, -7.9, quite dim, is disappearing into the evening twilight as well. So not much to see up there just at the moment, unfortunately.
Not planet-wise, no. Just a few pointers for you. Tomorrow morning, if you're looking for Jupiter, it's 7. Actually, it's in the morning. Yes, it'll be 7 degrees to the left of the moon. And the following day, it'll be about 7 degrees to the right of the moon. As you mentioned, John, the ISS not visible in Irish skies, certainly not in the evening skies. I believe it starts a series of morning passes later in the month, around about the 17th, but still too unsociable hour for most of us. But we still, of course, have the moon and the sun, and at the moment we have a 21% waxing crescent moon, which is on view at the moment if the sky is clear where you are, but it will set tonight just before 10 minutes to 11 this evening, when you'll see about 1% more of it, because it is a waxing crescent moon. And when it rises tomorrow morning at just before half past nine, it'll be a 26% phase. And when it's due south tomorrow at 4:41 p.m, that's when it crosses the meridian and is at its highest, we'll have a 29% waxing crescent phase as we head towards the first quarter moon, which will be on Friday the 16th at 3 p.m. exactly, to be precise. And we have sunrise tomorrow in Dublin at 7:46 a.m, which is 13 minutes earlier than a week ago. Local noon, when the sun passes the meridian, or due south of us, that's at 12:39 p.m. And the sun sets, who'd believe it, 5:32 p.m. tomorrow, 13 minutes later than 1 week ago. And from then until just about 10 past 6, we have civil twilight, and from 10 past 6 to 10 to 7 we have nautical twilight, and then from 10 to 7 till 7:30 exactly. We have astronomical twilight, and after that we have nighttime officially begins. That means we will have 27 minutes more daylight than a week ago, and tomorrow another 3 minutes and 58 seconds between sunrise and sunset, when the time between sunrise and sunset will be 9 hours and 46 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That's for Dublin. Not that much different for anywhere else in the country, though.
Now, the Japanese have postponed their next-gen rockets launched over the weather, unfortunately. They decided earlier on to postpone the launch of its next-generation rocket planned for this week. And that is solely due to bad weather on the way. And it's had two previous attempts, which also ended in failure. The H3 rocket had been scheduled to lift off last Thursday from the southern island of Tanegashima, whatever way you want to pronounce that one. Billed as flexible and the cost-effective new flagship, it was to carry two small satellites during the mission intended to prove it can actually get into orbit. So, the weather at the moment is expected to worsen, so they decided to postpone the launch, and a new date would be announced one a decision has been made, so no date for the rescheduling of the launch time for that one. And they included the first H3 launch attempt last February last year. I don't know if you remember that one, Ben. I do vaguely. And it was already delayed by several years at that stage. And that particular one was abandoned when the solid rocket boosters didn't ignite. So, yeah, not looking good there, but it's just a weather thing this time, so we'll reschedule. Now, where the weather pocket is, the timing to get it into space, I'm not exactly sure yet, but we will keep an eye on that to see where things are.
Thank you, John. Do you remember the Stratospheric Observatory?
Yes.
For infrared astronomy, mm-hmm. Or SOFIA?
Mm-hmm.
That was the big jumbo jet.
Mm-hmm.
With the huge panel, like a big door, they took off the side, and there was a telescope in it. Now, how you're supposed to do any observing on a jet aircraft
with the side missing?
With a hole in the side, and I presume they had some good adaptive optics. Well, that was retired some time ago, but the data is still being poured over, and some people have been looking at it, and they said they have made a big discovery about water molecules on the surface of asteroids. They were looking at particular asteroids, and they say there's water molecules on it. And I'm just wondering, this follows on from a recent, I suppose, theory. Up until very recently, we thought all the water on Earth had come from basically comets.
Mm-hmm.
In the early days of the formation of the Earth, comets being mostly what we generally described as dirty snowballs. And then a few years ago we started reading about some people who believe, well, maybe a lot of the water came from asteroids, which sounds a bit strange because we imagine asteroids as being just big dry lumps of rock. But they were looking at four silicate-rich asteroids with certain instruments, and they say that, of course, asteroids are leftovers from planetary formation process, so the composition can vary depending on where they formed in the solar nebula. Those formed nearer the sun would not surprisingly have less water on them, and the ones out further might have a bit more water and be have more water in their composition. But they say the discovery is particularly intriguing given the nature of asteroid studies because silicate asteroids, typically anhydrous and forming closer to the sun, contrast with the icy materials found further out in the solar system. And so they're suggesting the distribution of water throughout the solar system is a little bit more complex than previously thought, and the significance of this discovery extends beyond understanding the past. It also shapes future exploratory efforts. So if you can identify where the water is in the solar system, you can, or out in deep space, you can better assess where you might look for signs of life beyond Earth. So they want to study a few more, and they want to get more sensitive instruments. And of course, this team are looking for some time on the James Webb Space Telescope, because that is much more sensitive to what they're looking for than the instruments, than the telescope that they've used, or the data from the telescope. So, yeah, this just further adds to that theory that we covered in the past about where the water on Earth came from. Maybe it didn't come from, or certainly not all of it. Probably did not come from comets as we previously thought. Maybe more of it did come from the impact of asteroids and the early formation of the Earth.
How did it know when to stop?
When to stop what?
Filling with water. Otherwise you'd have a scene from that Kevin Costner film where it was just everything had melted and everything, all the land was under sea and everything. So
oh, was that Water World?
Water World. Well worth a watch, that.
I haven't seen it.
Now, if you're in the market for a telescope, now I've gone through this a number of times before Christmas and just after, but I spotted this earlier on today. It's a Celestron Astromaster LT70AZ beginner telescope. And it's $60. Yep, that's the cheapest one I've seen. It's well worth a punt. The only thing it doesn't have is a electric motor in it to help stick it on, but you have this little twisty thing that helps you find things, because telescopes tend to let the object that you're viewing disappear. So if you're going out for a sip of tea, when you come back, it's gone out of the screen. So you've got to be careful with this. So just remember that name, Celestron Astromaster LT70AZ, and it's $60. And that'll be a good one. That won't be like the National Geographic ones or things like that, the cheapy ones.
That's 60 millimeter.
70 millimeter
yeah. Refractor.
Oh. Yeah. Yep. It's quite a good that looking one as well. And it's got a tripod and everything. So if you are in the beginner's world and you don't want to take too much risk, and they do this as well, so it's a low risk price. It's usually about $130 or thereabouts. So you will find it all around the internet, I would imagine. And this particular thing was with Walmart over there in the US. So if you have an account with Walmart, you're flying.
I'm sure you can get them on Amazon or wherever.
Any of the rest of them, yeah.
Yeah. There you go. Now, solar sails, another subject we've covered in the past also, and there are a lot of different companies, especially in the USA, and they're working on developing solar sails. And NASA, of course, are involved in this, and they plan to unfurl plans for solar sail technology as a promising method of deep space transportation. Now, at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, they, along with a private company, developed and they deployed a mechanism and of a nearly 100-foot long boom, which provided the sail membrane, basically. Yeah. And this is only one quarter of the solar sail. Maybe we should say a bit about what solar sails are. It's a propulsion system powered by sunlight, reflecting from the sail, much like a sailboat reflects the wind. And when they had unfurled just one quarter of this sail successfully, although it's just one quarter, the complete sail will measure 17,800 square feet when fully deployed, which is, let's face it, pretty big. But it has only the thickness of less than a human hair at 2.5 microns across. And that consists of a layer of a polymer material coated with aluminium. So there's some technology there. So it has to be very, basically it's very light. And it's, I presume the idea is to, you launch a craft and then you deploy a solar sail as big as a football pitch. And it catches the particles from the sun and is basically, once the sun keeps shining, the engines keep running, so it's going to be a cheap way. I think we covered this a few years ago, but somebody had thought this might be a great way to send a probe all the way to the nearest star system, Alpha Centauri, and that it could perhaps accelerate the little craft, which would only be the size of, well, less than the size of a mobile phone, and that you could accelerate it up to one quarter or so, or one fifth of the speed of light, which is a horrendous speed. But, and therefore at that rate, being 4 or 5 light years away, it would take a mere 20 years to get there. Take a little photograph, send it back. See little green men on the planets below. That would be. So, yeah, that's. I said once the sun is shining, the thing will keep moving, and that you could give it a boost with a laser from Earth, sort of accelerate it on its way. So there's a lot more to happen over the coming years with solar sails.
There certainly is. Now, sticking with the speed of light, or as close as we can get to it, what would happen if you moved at the speed of light? I suppose the big issue you'd face is reaching that speed in the first place, which is impossible. So science fiction is probably the way to go on this one. People often find a way to move at the speed of light, but you might find yourself asking questions. Could your body survive going so fast, and what would actually happen to it? So first, let's assume that it is possible, though it's not, for a human to move at the speed of light, which is 299,792,458 meters per second. Now, that's a number hard to get a grasp around. 186,000 miles per second is probably an easier one for us to grasp, because we're well used to it. So there's no issue per se when a person is moving at a very fast constant speed. And as we know, that humans can't feel constant velocity, so you wouldn't even necessarily notice that you were moving that fast. That's probably similar to flying in an aircraft, because you could be doing up to 500 miles an hour. You don't feel as if you're moving at all unless you look out the window. And even things down there are quite things. So the problem, I think, really is the acceleration, which actually reaching that speed, too much acceleration force can hurt and probably even kill us. So
I don't know. It was theorized back in the day when the motor car was invented after been going using horses and carts for since time. I was going to say since people appeared on the earth, that it was theorized as if that the human body wouldn't be able to handle going at more than maybe 10 or 20 miles an hour or something like that. But of course, we now know that not to be true. You're listening to The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett, and our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie, and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032.
Just one more point, just on the acceleration forces. You and I, as being normal...
normal.
Let's think about it. We'll rethink that one. So we could handle probably 4 to 6 times gravity, which is 4 to 6 G in our language. Some of the fighter pilots can handle up to 9, but they're trained to sort of scrunch muscles in there.
They have those special flight suits as well that stop all the blood draining to their feet or their head. Yeah, but it must be very tight and constricted in there, I imagine, in those flight suits when they're traveling, experiencing those G forces.
Yep. So, in a nutshell, if you wanted to accelerate to light speed more safely, say 2G, for example, which wouldn't be terribly comfortable, it would take over 5 months to accelerate to light speed, assuming that you were moving in a straight line, there was no air resistance at all, and if you were at 1G, the acceleration of free fall, it would take over 11 months to get there. So, let's not even go that way.
Yeah.
It's not recommended, so it wouldn't be terribly comfortable anyway.
Thank you, John. I see there's an international symposium planned for March 21st, 22nd in Turin in Italy. And the whole idea is to delve into the critical issues of preserving the moon's far side. So basically, there's a lot of groups and people getting together. And the whole objective, I suppose, is to come to an agreement that that people won't and countries won't be able to will agree not to make claims on the moon, or, I suppose, pollute it with, dump the rubbish there, like nuclear waste or whatever. There's a lot of international organizations and private and public companies going to that. But I know there are already, isn't it, back in the Apollo days, there was... I know the USA and the Soviet Union came to an agreement beforehand, and I think with other countries as well agreed that there wouldn't be that nobody will claim or colonise the moon.
Now, in saying that, I have a certificate. Somebody did it.
You have a piece of paper, Jeff.
I certainly have. It's in the Charlie Quadrant, which is just to the left of the left eye, up just a little bit above that. It's an acre. And keep off my space. If I have an electrified fence up there, so nobody can get in whatsoever. Now, just for a few moments, on January the 26th, just gone past, 20 people were in space at the very same time. So there was a mix between the International Space Station, which hosted 11, 7 long-term crew members and 4 visitors on the private AX3 mission, and on the Chang'eong station, the Chinese one, there were 3 as well. So for a very short moment of time, there were 20 people actually up in space, which is quite unusual, and there were a lot of them there in the International Space Station, so I can imagine there. Okay, your turn to breathe. Hold your breath there for 2 minutes. Yep, otherwise we'll use up all the oxygen. So that's remarkable. I think that's the most that ever has been in space at any one time. So it's
on two space stations.
On two space stations. It would have been probably, much better fun probably on the Chinese one, because there's not so many people. You can play hide and seek better there. We'll lose a couple of tomatoes as well.
Tomatoes again. Okay. John, tell us about heading towards the ends of the earth.
Yeah.
Before I try and find some time to talk about cannibalizing stars.
Yeah, that's I did have that later. Actually, we're running quickly out of time here. Oh, yes, here we go. 2 new miniature satellites, the little guys. These are going to start crisscrossing Earth's atmosphere in a few months' time, detecting heat loss to space. And their observations from the planet's most bone-chilling regions will help predict how our ice, seas and weather will change in the face of global warming. So I think these satellites are going to go around North, South Pole, that sort of thing, a little bit more different than the way that a lot of these shoebox satellites and things are up there at the moment. The Cube satellites is what they're called. And it's a mission called Prefire, short for Polar Radiant Energy, in the Far Infrared Experiment, equipped with technology proven at Mars. So that's the two guys. Have we got names for these yet? They're just shoebox size. They're only, these size 7 or size 5? I don't know. Have to wait and see. 2 little CubeSats comprising of their mission. Remember the name again, Prefire. And this has been jointly developed by NASA and the University of Wisconsin in Madison, which teams members from the universities of Michigan and Colorado. So the mission starts with Earth's energy budget, and it's a planetary balancing act. The amount of heat energy the planet receives from the sun should ideally be offset by the amount it radiates out of the Earth system into space. Now that makes total sense, which is a good thing. So eventually they're going to measure little things like this as well. So we'll keep an eye on Prefire. That's a good name. Yep, like that one.
Thank you, John. I'll try and get through this. Briefly, about cannibalized stars, I see that some scientists are working with some powerful telescopes over there in Georgia State Center for High Angular Resolution Astronomy, or CARA. And they've completed a survey of a particular group of stars that they suspect to have devoured most of their gas from orbiting companion stars. So this is basically where one star cannibalizes another. So the work identifies new orbits of stripped subdwarf stars that circle fast-spinning massive stars. And that's of course leading us to a new understanding of the life trajectory of close binary stars. Now they're looking at what we call B emission line stars, or BE stars for short. And these are rapidly rotating stars thought to harbour unusual orbiting companions. Stars, as we know, normally occur in pairs. And this is, of course, a trend that's especially true among stars more massive than our sun. But pairs with a small separation face what they say are a tumultuous destiny, because they grow in size as they age and can reach a dimension similar to their separation. So they begin to emerge, and when that happens, the gas from the growing star can cross the gap between the pairs, so that the companion one star feasts upon the transferred gas stream, and this cannibalization process eventually strips away put a lot of the mass of the donor star and leaving all, basically taking all its gas away and leaving behind a tiny hot core of its former nuclear burning center. And this is another case where another group are looking to get their hands on the James Webb Space Telescope to do further studies on that. Just before I finish up for us, John. Oh, yes, Alan has been in touch. The weather's not good in Kildare, unfortunately.
Yeah. It's not so good up here either, so you're okay. Yeah, so there we go. Just to mention, a sunspot 15 times wider than the Earth could soon bombard us with solar flares. This is an absolute monster. It's 200,000 kilometers across and much the same out. It contains at least four dark cores, each larger than the Earth. So I'm going to keep an eye on this. I just want to see when we're going to maybe have little radio blackouts and television things and all that sort of stuff. But you can actually see this particular sunspot from Earth if you have the correct equipment with the filters and everything. So it's not going to disappear very, very quickly indeed. So we'll just keep an eye on that one over the next day or two to see what happens there.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you, Alan, for your further texts and compliments on the show. We do appreciate it. Absolutely. That's why we're here. One of the reasons we're here.
Yep. Well, are we time for one more?
Yeah,
we'll go for it. Okay. Geminid meteor shower is one of my favorites as well. They may be 10 times older than thought. Simulations have been sort of calculated on this of the oddball asteroid Phaeton and the comet-like asteroid Phaeton, which likely lobbed thousands of rocky fragments towards the Earth while rapidly spinning around the Sun 18,000 years ago. And it may fling some more soon our direction. So we're going to keep an eye on that one. The Geminids are when? The end of every year, which we've just gone through those, so we'll have to wait. Yeah, so there we go. So the rocks making up the Geminid meteor shower that occur towards the end of every year, which is sort of in sort of December-y time, would have been born through the chaotic event 18,000 years ago. So we go through that every, like we do with every meteor shower. And we get some fantastic views of little ones and medium ones and large ones. So it's interesting to see that the simulations have told us now that they're about 10 times older at this stage than previously thought.
Thank you, John, for that. And you reminded me of the John Spillane song, about doing orbits around the sun. The cherry tree.
Yeah.
Well done, everyone. Because I was just looking at cherry trees the other day. I saw some almost in full bloom. So not quite in full bloom, but some of them are, depending on where they're located. Anyway, that's another story. Our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie. And thanks to John for his latest news, and thanks to James Sweeney and Conor Lennon for making the show available on astronomy.ie, and the good people here in 103.2 Dublin City FM who put the show up as a podcast also. But that's all from me, Ben Emmett, from this edition of the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. And it's music all the way now until 2 a.m. because up next we have Bren Lynott with Threads, and from 10 p.m. to midnight, Ear to the Globe with Nigel Wood, and from midnight till 2 a.m. it's Dave Barry's mix of jazz, blues and soul with a program called After Hours. Please join John next week at 7:30 p.m. and the week after, because I have two trips to make, which unfortunately coincide with Tuesday nights, but I plan to be back in 3 weeks' time. Anyway, please join next week and the week after, when he'll be back anyway, with the latest news from all corners and dimensions of the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening, and say good night, John.
Good night, John.
Good night, John.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.